Joy Rustoven is with Survive It, which is an organization that helps to get cancer information to people who are recently diagnosed, and I'm guessing also to continue to help them with information as time moves forward in their life.
That's right.
Okay, well, Joy, thanks for being here. And Joy is the executive director of Survive It. So let's just start with the basics so people know what it is we're talking about. You know, I kind of hinted at it. It's, you know, information, resource, that kind of thing. But you tell us what you like to, you know, explain it as.
Sure. Thanks for having us, Anne.
Sure.
Delighted to be here. So Survive It is a national cancer patient advocate. We are survivors helping patients at our core. Think of us as advocates who actually know the system. Our mission is to empower you to define your journey and face cancer on your own terms. And our vision is a world free from the fear of cancer.
Free of the fear of cancer. That's
right.
A big goal.
It is. Yes. It was actually inspired by our late founder, Matt Ellefson. Matt lived nearly 10 years with advanced lung cancer, and he was the best. He was so inspiring. He loved mentoring patients and caregivers. And the way that he navigated the cancer care system inspired the website today, surviveit.org, but it also inspired a new cancer navigation tool that we're building and I'm excited to talk about today.
Well, yeah, that was going to be my next question, the motivation for creating all of this. So go ahead. Mm-hmm. I mean, you've told us a little bit, but you know, elaborate on that as far as, you know, so I guess I'm guessing that he had trouble finding the information and the resources he needed. So he was like, I'm going to create this.
That's right. So when Matt was diagnosed in late 2008, the two things that he was looking for was he wanted to know who the best lung cancer doctor was because he wanted to get in front of them. And he also wanted to talk to a survivor because he wanted to know what they did and how they did this. And so the organization has evolved. The website currently has a ton of great resources. They really run the gamut of the patient and caregiver journey. And as cancer is evolving as far as what we're understanding about it and how we're treating it, the resources that we have created are also up to date.
So we say the resources, I mean, beyond just information.
That's right. And that's something that we're pretty passionate about here is when you're diagnosed with cancer, it is information overload. It doesn't help that you retain less than 15% of the information that comes after the news that you have cancer. And there's only 27 days is the median actually between the diagnosis and your first line of treatment. So between that time, you'll hear a lot that you just need to educate yourself on the disease and, you know, read as much as you possibly can. But there's so much more than just the medicine. That's a huge part of it. But there's the psychosocial, there's the caregiver, there's nutrition, which is what most people turn to first. So it's a lot of information. And so what we want to do is simplify the steps to take. One of the things that you'll hear most from survivors is that you've got to advocate for yourself. That's an admissions officer at our cancer center told me and my dad is you're going to be your dad's biggest advocate, which, you know, me in my late 20s, that was terrifying because I didn't know anything about cancer.
Right.
I didn't know how to navigate it. And so my experience, the experience of our survivor advisory with the oversight of our medical advisory is really shaping the resources that you see on surviveit.org, but also this new tool.
Okay. And I think everybody could understand how it's an information overload. If you didn't go to medical school, you're starting way behind the curve. I mean, even if you did, unless you were studying that, you still don't have all that information. And you're expected to make decisions that are important and in a relatively short amount of time. And I, you know, the worse the diagnosis, the shorter the time is.
That's right. There's certainly a sense of urgency. You know, many of us want to jump into the first available option. But as I mentioned, the information that we're learning about cancer, you know, we're going much further into just where we found it in your body. And so thankfully, our treatment options are expanding. We're becoming more targeted. It affects your quality of life less. We're seeing outcomes increase. And so it's so much information to take in. And so we think we've done a nice job of simplifying the information, feeding it to you, or your loved ones in a way that's easy to digest. It's relevant to your specific type of cancer, and it certainly provides you with a sense of control in such a helpless situation.
You know, you talked about the information and keeping current. You know, there's a lot of types of cancer. There's a lot of information. So how are you guys going about, you know, keeping the latest information about every type that's out there, kind of?
Right. So we try to focus on the process. In the new tool, we talk about the five steps. But on the current website, you'll find resources. The one that's coming to mind right now is our Start Here guide. There's two action items related to that, and it starts with making sure you have a thorough diagnosis, and then it's followed up by getting a qualified second opinion. So going back to how much and how fast this landscape is changing, we think it's critical to get comprehensive molecular profiling and a qualified second opinion. And I know those are foreign, it's almost like a foreign language when you get into all of this. So We're mindful of the amount of information we put forward, and we always assign an action item so people actually know how to implement that into their personal journey.
Yeah, and a second opinion is very important, not just cancer, but everything, but more so, again, the more serious it is, then the more important it is that you have a second opinion, because I would imagine most cancers have more than one path that you can choose and options all along the way that you have to make decisions, and so you need to hear it from more than one person so that you can figure out what you really want to do.
That's right. Because, you know, thankfully, because of cancer research, we have targeted therapies now. So it's not just chemo and radiation anymore is the only thing on the table. You know, let's talk about clinical trials. It's basically tomorrow's medicine that you can get today. So yes, totally agree.
Yeah. Aside from clinical trials, do you have links or resources about studies that are, or things that people are looking at that aren't really available yet? Because, you know, I think sometimes that's harder to come by. You know, if you go to 10 websites, they're all going to sort of regurgitate the same tried and true, they'll call it standard of care. But sometimes that just means it's the old way of doing things. And, you know, if it was me, I'd want to know, well, what are they working on? Even if it's not quite available yet, like, what's the new thinking, even if it's not ready?
That's right. And that was my mentality when I was caring for my dad, is I wanted the best treatment option for him, not necessarily the first available. So currently on the website, we have a newsroom, and we are constantly posting to that. If there is any breakthroughs, if there's a new FDA approved drug, a clinical trial that's showing promise, folks can find that information there.
Okay. Excellent. Good to know. We're going to check on traffic and weather here in just a moment, but I also, when we come back, I want to talk about funding, not because you have startup costs, you have ongoing costs, and I'm sure people are like, is this free? Do I have to pay for it? And if it's a free resource, then of course, how do you continue to fund it going forward? Because there's a lot of work involved in getting all that information out there. And you have more than one thing going on right now, right? I mean, you have the existing website, but you also have some new things coming.
We do. Yeah. I'm excited to talk about that.
Okay. Give us a hint.
Well, it's called the Cancer Co-Pilot, and this is actually the first time I'm publicly talking about it.
Oh my gosh, I have a scoop.
Exclusive.
An exclusive. So, well, and so the Cancer Co-Pilot, is that going to be like an app instead of a website, or?
It's a web-based app. So okay. Yes, everything digital at this point.
Okay, great. So we'll take a quick break here for traffic and weather. We'll come back and talk more with Joy Rustoven with Survive It, the organization, and her Cancer Co-Pilot, which is something new. And I'm sure people are going to be happy to hear about that. But right now, traffic and weather, WICC 600. Ann Carrick here, your guest host for the week, Connecticut Today. And my guest this half hour is Joy Rustoven, and she is with Survive It, which currently has a website that has resources for people recently diagnosed with cancer and also to help answer questions throughout the whole process. And as we went to the break, though, you were telling us that this new venture, I guess we'll call it, that you're working on is Cancer Co-Pilot, which is an online app. So tell us more about that, and how is that different than the existing website, surviveit.org?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm thrilled to tell you about this because this is filling a need like never before. There is nothing like this out there. No one is taking the comprehensive journey and making it in a way that's accessible, and it's as though we're walking hand in hand with the patient or caregiver. So we simplified it into 5 steps. It's comprehensive, as I mentioned, and it's actionable. This is where we focus. So it's not enough to just educate patients and shout awareness from the rooftops anymore. You know, we want to know what we can actually do in the situation. And so that's what this tool is meant to do. It's personalized and it's always free, which I know we'll talk about that shortly, but it's 5 steps, it's all online, and it's personalized to both patients and caregivers. And again, we're supporting anyone facing any type of cancer.
And is this something that you envision people using, like even if they've recovered and they're, you know, either remission or we'll call it like permanent remission, meaning like they really don't have any issue that they're dealing with and unless something new pops up mm-hmm. where they're kind of moving on. Do you envision that they will continue to use this resource?
Yes. From experience, what we've seen, we've got some lovely individuals on our Survivor Advisory Council, everything ranging from survivor's guilt to long-term side effects from treatment, to the community support. I mean, I understand that once you're diagnosed with cancer, it really affects your life forever.
Okay. I think the long-term side effects are something that nobody talks about very much. Mm-hmm. You know, people, especially if they haven't had a cancer, I think they're very focused on, you know, getting to remission and everything. So then it's just back to life as normal, you know, moving on. For some people, maybe that is true, but depending on the treatment that person had, it can be very long lasting things that just never change. They never go back to anything close to normal. You know, they can deal with it and live with it, but they don't revert back to something that you would call normal.
That's right.
Yeah.
And thankfully we have been blessed with a group of people who have wanted to turn their experience, use their collective knowledge about navigating the system and helping those that will come after us. I mean, there's just so much information in today's world of Google. We have access to more information than we could possibly need. And, you know, once you're in that situation, you only have so many hours in the evening to Google. And so we're excited about this tool because we have created and curated the best of the best. So it's comprehensive, starting with the diagnosis, moving all the way to those survivorship resources.
Okay. And just in case somebody wants to know more, right now, I'm guessing their best way to find out about the Cancer Co-Pilot is to go to Indiegogo, which is I-N-D-I-E, go-go, and look for Cancer Co-Pilot. And there's a video there, because I went to look at it, that sort of explains what it's going to be, even though it's not quite there yet. Because I know the website, at a glance, you feel like it's the same thing. But you were telling before we started that the website's going away. It's going to be replaced with something that looks different. So what's there now is not what it will look like later.
That's right. And we decided to do this because there are so many great resources out there, but it's not necessarily intuitive as to where you start and what you do next. And so everything on the current website will live on the new tool, but there's just a place for it. So whenever you are using this as a patient or a caregiver, we've thoughtfully put it in the sequence of events, you know, the most relevant time for you.
Okay. And you've touched on it, but for people listening, how is this going to be different than if they're just searching information on their own?
Right. So going back to the comprehensive approach to this tool, so it's 5 simplified steps. We start with a diagnosis. We're calling it test it. And the second step is called verify. It's getting that qualified second opinion. And going back to the actionability, it's not enough for us to encourage folks to get that qualified second opinion. We're actually doing the research to figure out who the thought leaders are, who are the best in class specialists in that type of cancer. So we've got a list for that. Step 3 is called match it, and that's where we are encouraging the patient to find their voice, to identify their goals, so they can actually bring that to the table and be a part of the decision-making process. Step 4 is called support it. So if the patient has decided to pursue treatment, we want to support you and get you through that line of therapy. And then the 5th step is called live it. And so that is our survivor vetted resource library. That's where a ton of really great resources out there. Thankfully, we have wonderful advocacies. We've got for-profits that are supporting patients well. And so we vet them and we put them in the category that they fit, and patients and caregivers can come and go as they please.
Okay. And also we wanted to talk a little bit about funding. I know I asked you all these other questions in between, but so how is it funded, like, to get started? How's it going to continue to be funded? Because you've already said it's free to people who are using it.
That's right. We will never charge patients, caregivers, or survivors to use this tool. Thankfully, we have a fantastic donor base. We've received grants from some of the for-profits. We've got some promising conversations with some of the pharmaceutical companies. They've been fantastic to work with. I think that we collectively all have a goal to improve the outcomes for patients. And so if we can work together, if we can get this project funded, then I think we'll be in a place to do that. So we chose Indiegogo. It's a crowdfunding platform. And that's where you can go to learn more about the tool. And we're divulging more information about each of the steps there. And if you feel so inclined, you can support us in backing this project.
Okay. So we're about out of time. Any parting thoughts? I know Indiegogo.com and search Cancer Copilot, SurviveIt.org for more information. What else do you want somebody to know before we say goodbye?
You can find us on all social media platforms. So we connect with our community that way. We'll certainly be talking much more about the Cancer Copilot, and we look forward to serving the community.
All right, Joy. Thank you very much. Again, Joy Rusthoven with SurviveIt.org. So if you want to find out more right this minute, we're going to go ahead and take a break for traffic and weather and news at the bottom of the hour. When we come back, we're going to have Coach Connie from California talking about COVID and coping. Any more C's, I'll work them in there. Don't worry about it. Right here in WICC 600. This half hour, we are speaking to Professor Ed Lynch from Hollins University in Virginia, professor and chair of political science. So, Ed, thanks for being here. Regular listeners may have heard you before. You've been a guest before.
Thank you for having me again, Anne. It's good to be with you on the air again.
Yeah, and I love having you, especially when it's election season, because you always have things to say. Let me just take a wild guess. You have been following the Democratic National Convention, probably.
Yes, I'm one of the minority who's doing so. And I don't say that glibly, but the ratings have been down just about 50% from 4 years ago, which I don't think is terribly surprising. I mean, you don't have the excitement of a hall and balloons and costumes and state signs and looking for, you know, prominent politicians in the crowd. I think the last thing many Americans want is to watch another Zoom call, which is essentially what the conventions are, Republican and Democrat, are going to be this time.
Right. I noticed that the broadcast networks all went to 1 hour of coverage a night, where they're sort of just summarizing what happened, as opposed to carrying the whole thing live. PBS is still doing like 3 hours a night or something. And the news channels is a whole different story. But I was like, well, that's probably, they realized too that, you know, 3 hours of a Zoom type of convention wasn't going to fly.
Well, you know, I remember talking to a reporter friend years ago who was in the pool at one of the conventions in the hall, and they had the press pool in a room off the off the main floor, where they had the television coverage on a 7 second delay, but they could hear the speakers as they were talking. And one of the reporters said, only about 10 minutes of that is necessary to induce homicidal fury. So if we compare that with a 3 hour Zoom call, essentially, then I think we understand why the networks aren't doing that.
Right. And because everything is recorded, I'm sure they've gotten previews of what each person is planning to say. And so it makes it easy for them to take the feed and cut it up and have it ready to go and summarize everything in an hour. You do, of course, get their take on it as opposed to getting to see it yourself and drawing your own conclusion. But from a pure, like, summarizing standpoint, an hour gets the job done. So we're about halfway through the convention. What's your take so far? Are you seeing a trend in message? Or I know my previous guest was talking about she was seeing a lot of empathy. She was viewing it as a life coach, and she's like, but you need more than empathy. You need some action items too, you know?
Well, I mean, there are a number of things going on. First of all, when you have a party that's challenging for the White House, like the Democrats are now, naturally a part of your message, and maybe a big part of your message, is going to be the perceived failures of the party in office, in this case, Trump and the Republicans. That's appropriate, but it can't be just that. And that's all we've seen from the Democrats the first couple of nights, is negativity on Donald Trump personally to a large extent. And of course, he asked for that, you know, the outsized personality that he's got. But, you know, okay, so what else? I mean, I compare it with when Reagan was running against Carter back in 1980, it was also a sort of crisis atmosphere, not as serious as this one and not affecting nearly as many people, but the hostage crisis was going on. The Soviets were in Afghanistan. There were things happening. And Reagan, of course, talked about those things, and he criticized Jimmy Carter roundly for doing that. But he also had a very specific program of things that I want to do, whether tax cuts, cutting spending, building up the military. You know, look, you can argue that those were terrible things to do, but at least Reagan was saying, this is what I'm going to do. Now, Kamala Harris and Joe Biden have yet to speak. Maybe they'll go in that direction, but you know, the convention only lasts for 4 nights. It's your big chance. And I haven't seen a lot of positive ideas. At this point, I think in a crisis like the one that we're in right now, I think a lot of Americans are asking, so what are you going to do about it?
Right.
And they haven't the answer to that yet.
Well, and maybe, let's hope, because it's halfway through, you know, that they're going to shift now and focus more on, you know, the action items. This is what we would do, should do, think we need to do, given where we are now, which I realize is all hypothetical when you're not the one in office, but that's all you have, you know. And you kind of alluded to it, that the convention is sort of this 4-day span where you get to say what you want to say and nobody counters you. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is your opportunity to really lay it all out there. Like, this is what we're about. This is what we want to do. This is our plan. And what you're saying is, so far, that we've just heard the kind of attack the opponent, which is all part of it, but mostly sure. That and not much of the plan.
That's true. And the other thing that I've noticed is that the planners for the Democratic National Convention have made a couple of errors so far that have made the news that really were easily avoided. One of the real rising stars in the Democratic Party, Representative Ocasio-Cortez from New York, never mentioned Joe Biden in her speech. And in fact, she talked mostly about Bernie Sanders. She never mentioned the actual candidate, the nominee. And then they also had a woman who was kicked out of the Women's March for making anti-Semitic remarks. She was photographed with a group called Muslims for Biden. Those are the sorts of errors you really want to avoid. And Joe Biden should know better. He's been going to political conventions since the 1970s, maybe since the 1960s.
He's not a newbie to the political environment.
No. And one of the ways that we assess candidates for president is how they run a 4-day multifaceted convention, a particular challenge for Democrats traditionally. Nothing against today's Democrats, but they've always been a little bit more boisterous, a little more unpredictable, lively. You know, Republican conventions tend to, you know, sound more like Kiwanis meetings, whereas Democratic conventions, you know, there's fights in the aisles, and there's
a lot of energy.
A lot of energy. Yeah. So it is arguably more of a challenge to run a Democratic convention, but it doesn't compare to the challenge of running the White House.
Exactly. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Traffic and weather here on WICC 600. We'll come back and talk more with Professor Ed Lynch about politics, basically. Don't go away. Welcome back. Ann Carrick, your guest host, and my guest this half hour, Ed Lynch, professor and chair of political science at Hollins University in Virginia. So, Ed, we've been talking a lot about the elections, and during the break you just mentioned that there's a new poll or report out related to Kamala Harris specifically. And so what's that all about?
Well, this is from Rasmussen Reports, and they're a very reputable polling agency. They were one of the few that predicted the 2016 election more or less correctly. That is, they saw, you know, Donald Trump gaining steam in the last days of the campaign. So they're a pretty reputable group, and they released a poll today indicating something very surprising, at least to me. 1/3 of African-American voters said they are less likely to vote for Biden now that he has chosen Kamala Harris as his vice presidential candidate. Another third of that same African-American sample said more likely. And then, of course, you know, you've got those who for whom it didn't make any difference.
Right.
They were either going to vote for or against Biden, and she didn't change the equation. But given the fact that she is African-American herself, and that was fulfilling a campaign promise, that it didn't solidify, absolutely solidify the African-American base, at least in the early going, I think Democrats have to find that a little concerning.
Well, you know, I have no idea why, you know, unless they just, you know, like a third of the people didn't care for her for whatever, you know, no, they don't care what color she is kind of thing. Or if they wanted somebody who was, I'll call it more specifically African-American, because I guess she's Jamaican and from in India, like the, or something. So she's obviously black in color, but maybe they wanted somebody who was more in line with the African-American community. Or that's what I said. Who knows? Because it didn't really give a reason. I'm sure they polled them. It just said, you know, who do you like? It didn't say why, right?
Well, I mean, the question was, are you more or less likely to vote for the Democratic ticket now that Kamala Harris is on it?
Oh, okay. And it is surprising that a third are less likely.
That's right. That's why I brought it up. It's a surprising number. And I think it really says more about campaigning in the 21st century than it might say about either Harris or Biden. What I mean by that is campaigns in recent years have become very, very group oriented. We appeal to Hispanics. We appeal to people in the South. We appeal to farmers. And they lose the fact that voters are individuals and they make decisions on an individual basis. Kamala Harris has taken some very liberal positions in her career in the Senate. She, of course, had a very checkered history as a prosecutor, locking a lot of people up. She was, in fact, you know, part of the whole mass incarceration thing from that position. And I think it's probably African-Americans who disagree with her on the issues.
Well, and, you know, I feel like the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, too. It's really both. Mm-hmm. But you've got these split off groups within both parties that are kind of extreme in either direction. And so it leaves a lot of party members, you know, that they don't know where to go, because you know, it feels like you have three parties inside one party, you know. And so if you're the centrist of your party and somebody is the leftist or the rightist in that same party, you don't really align with them. Maybe you still like them better than the other party. But you know what I'm saying? I feel like the extremes are becoming more and more common, and the people in the middle are becoming less common, and also the ones who are closer to the center in general, meaning closer to the other party, has become less so. So it's like everything is further out and makes it really hard for people to figure out which way to go.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that the Trump campaign capitalized on that back in 2016, splitting off some segments of the usually reliable Democratic base that they weren't expecting to get. You know, I'm kind of reminded of the comment by a British prime minister who said, you make a mistake in thinking of our parties as unified wholes. They're more like loose confederations of warring tribes. And there's a lot of truth to that in the Republicans and the Democrats as well. And the Republicans, look, the Republicans do this groupthink as well. It makes sense at a campaign meeting, and I've been at those meetings many times, strategizing how do we get this segment of the vote. In 2016, that's all that Hillary Clinton's campaign did. They did not do traditional polling, which is why they were surprised on Election Day.
I think everybody was surprised on Election Day, except for maybe like five people total. You know, I work the polls. And so I've said to people, I get home from the polls, maybe like 10:30 at night, by the time we tally up and paperwork and all this, and I, you know, drop off equipment. There's all this, you know, it's the elections. There's a lot of procedures that happen after 8 o'clock at night to make sure everything gets done right. And so I got home, I flipped on the TV. I'm like, you know, putting away things, washing, you know, things that I brought with me, like in a cooler for snacks, whatever, thinking, you know, they're going to announce that Hillary's, you know, wrapped it up kind of thing as we go to the West Coast. And it happened to coincide right with the time that all of the analysts on television sort of realized, like, wow, like, Trump wins this state, he's going to win. And so, all of a sudden there was sort of like weird silence. And so I looked around, I'm like, what's going on over there? You know, and there's all these people sort of deer in the headlights. Like, they didn't even know what to say because they were all caught off guard. I'm going to let you respond to that, but we have to check traffic and weather first. So we'll do that. WICC 600, we'll come back. We'll get Professor Ed Lynch's response to what I just said, and also ask you about the Democrats possibly taking control of the Senate after the election, right here on WICC 600. Back on Connecticut Today with our guest, Professor Ed Lynch, chair of the Political Science Department at Hollins University. And going to the break, I was saying how everybody was surprised on Election Day that Hillary Clinton did not win. I think Trump included, certainly Hillary Clinton included. So feel free to respond to that. And then also, you know, if Biden and Harris win, what effect, if any, do you think that'll have on the Senate? And if the Democrats take control of the Senate, what then? That's, I know, like five questions, but go ahead. Give it your best shot.
Well, this reminds me of sometimes when I give my students an exam and it will say, use the back of the page if necessary. I think that this, well, first of all, 2016, the one person who did know Trump was going to win was Melania. She told him that in 2015, you know, don't do this unless you're serious, because if you run, you're going to win. The phenomenon in 2016 that will be repeated in 2020 is the so-called shy Trump voter, a Trump voter who won't tell the pollster that's the way she or he is going to vote. Now, they might, you know, they don't want their neighbors to know or whatever, or they, like a lot of Trump voters, don't trust the major media. So they lie to them just to, you know, mess with them. And I remember thinking back in 2016, if Clinton is not up by at least 5 points, really six, on Election Day, she's in trouble. Well, she was up by five, won the popular vote, lost the electoral vote. And I think we're going to see that shy Trump voter phenomenon again this time, which is going to make the polls a little bit more difficult to follow. I think for your listeners, their best bet is to find a tracking poll and not take the absolute numbers, but look at the trend. You know, the Rasmussen tracking poll has Trump at 48%. Now, that might be off by as many as 4 points, but if it's 52 next week, that means he's doing better. If it's 44 next week, that means he's not doing as well. So you can sort of, you know, see the ups and downs, even if you can't track the number. Now, you asked me about the Senate, the United States Senate. I think the United States Senate will go with the White House. That is, if Trump is reelected, I think the Republicans are likely to retain the Senate. If the Democrats win, if Joe Biden wins the presidency, then I think the Senate will go that way as well. It's very close. I mean, they only need three or four seats to the Democrats to take over the Senate. And of course, if that happens, then the Democrats will also hold the House. Democrats may
at least
hold
till the next election. Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, when I look at some of the things that are going on, look, for the Democrats, the winning issue this time around is coronavirus and the response to it. It affects all of our lives, every minute of every day. Why they would want to change the subject to law and order, which has been a winning Republican issue since 1968, is something of a mystery to me. And if they're not doing it intentionally, then they're certainly not doing anything to sort of defuse that issue. The Republicans are able to show these pictures of, you know, cities that are burning and rioting and come up with crime statistics, including for New York City.
And the crime in New York City is rocketing.
Well, and people are leaving.
Yes.
I saw a statistic the other day. There are twice as many empty apartments in Manhattan as there were last July.
And the post office in Connecticut, you know, put out some numbers of how many people had put in a change of address from New York to Fairfield County, which of course is in striking distance. So even if your job were to return to the office in New York, which at the moment they're almost all remote,
right,
as witnessed by the empty train station parking lots. But you know, even if you need to go back, you can get there. And so, yes, thousands of people moving even to Connecticut, a lot more people moving to places like Florida saying, you know what, I'm working remotely. I can live anywhere. I'm out of here.
Yeah. And like I say, you know, this is this is something that Joe Biden has to take on in his speech tomorrow night. He has to address what's going on in the cities, all of which, by the way, are run by the Democratic Party, top to bottom within these cities. He has to do something about that. He has to talk about that. The advantage of going first in the conventions is that you get to preempt your opponent. You get to undercut their arguments before they get a chance to make them. If Biden does not take on the crime issue and the insecurity issue and the violence issue and the demonstrations issue, he has really missed a chance. And the Trump campaign will pounce on that like a pack of wolves.
Yeah, I'm sure they will, because they've been doing it anyway. I know I have some friends who have said they feel like some of the news networks are misportraying. Everybody seems to think that protests are not being portrayed accurately. Some think they're all peaceful and it's kumbaya. And others are like, what's wrong with you? They're like throwing bricks at police and trying to burn down a police precinct. What are you missing here? And we're all talking about the same story in the same city, which is baffling. You know, which goes back to my point of always watch more than one news source. I don't care which one you like, but watch more than one, and, you know, watch the one that's the opposite of the one you watch all the time. At least hear what they're saying and, you know, take a grain of salt there. But yeah, you're right, because if Biden doesn't address that, you know that the Trump campaign will be all over the increased crime in major metropolitan cities, which are predominantly Democrat mayors.
I can tell you this, if Bill Clinton were the nominee, law and order would be in the first three paragraphs of his speech tomorrow night. He would realize that he has to steal that issue or take that issue from the Republicans, and he would do it like he did with so many other issues, from crime to welfare reform to taxes. He was very good at that. We'll see if Biden's any good at that.
Yeah, very interesting. We're going to take one last break here for traffic and weather, and then we come back. We'll have about a minute. If you have a closing thought, you can share that right here on WICC 600. Don't go away. They're both named Susan, so we'll try to be clear who is saying what, and maybe it doesn't matter. The key part is Susan Starman and Susan Hubble are both from Portland, so I asked them to be here to talk about what's really going on in Portland, because, you know, here in Connecticut and in the greater New York area, we're getting, you know, the executive summary of what's happening in Portland, but you two are both really in Portland, so you can see it on a daily basis. Is that an accurate statement for both of you?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
You can't nod your head. It's radio. They can't hear you. Sorry about that. Just a reminder. I know you can see me, but right. So Susan Starman, let me start with you, because, you know, my understanding is that, especially before things maybe got as to the point where they are now, where we obviously there've been some issues now, but that you went to the protests early on and with your children, or just one child, I don't know, you can tell me, but that you went to show your support. So just give me what did you go to? Why did you choose to go? You know, give us a little information on that. And I guess I'll just say it, you know, that all three of us are white, in case anybody was wondering. So they, for perspective point of view. So tell us what caused you to make that decision, and what did you see and what happened? And when was it? And when was it? Yeah.
Sure. So I just to give people kind of a little bit of a picture, I have two daughters that are 16 and 18, and a husband. And so as I'm talking about our family unit, just so people kind of know what that is. And I think it's important for people to understand my kids' engagement in this process, because that has been really paramount to how we have chosen to participate. Early on, all of us participated in a couple of the marches, rallies, and my daughter, who is 16, has continued to participate in mostly smaller neighborhood rallies as we've gone through these now 80-some days. So that's kind of been our involvement in terms of being in the streets.
Okay. And what's the current, I mean, both of you can answer this, but like, what's the current situation from your perspective? You know, because I cover it from the news. And so obviously the news part of it, the big news is sadly is the violence that's, you know, that's happening at certain, and from what you said before we started here, some of that's dependent on the time of day. So what's your, explain for people who are sitting here on the East Coast, you know, what's going on from your perspective now? What's the situation in Portland now? And one of the things I'm curious is, are there parts of the town like Seattle where there was a group that had taken control, or is that not true? I mean, the last thing I heard was that more federal troops were coming back to protect federal buildings because they didn't think local authorities were. And again, that's at national level news that I'm hearing. So you tell us what's going on right now in Portland. We'll let Susan Hubble start first since you haven't said anything yet.
All right. Thanks. And I think from my perspective, what's going on now is multi-pronged. And I think that's maybe why what we as Portland residents experience is different than what people outside of Oregon see on the news. We do have a very passionate and active community in general. Marches and gatherings and demonstrations are not uncommon. And so there certainly was a robust response to Black Lives Matter and the general social unrest. And that's where we started. That said, earlier in the year, we had a lot of regular activity between political conservative groups and arguably politically liberal groups. And so from my vantage point, and I have not gone to physically participate in any of these 80 plus days worth of rallies, but from my perspective, we now have some groups that are demonstrating in support of Black Lives Matter. We have some resurgence of that political standoff. And then we have sort of another spur group of people who are really focused on local policing and defunding of the police, who are demonstrating daily as well, really focusing their attention on police precincts and headquarters and justice buildings and things like that. And I'm not confident that those groups are aligned, even much less have overlapping participants.
And do either of you, do you feel comfortable saying or knowing, or do you know, like, which of the groups are maybe the most responsible for the violence that we keep hearing about outside of the area? Like, we keep hearing about it, you know, is it the same group that's sort of perpetuating the violence while the other groups are being peaceful, or is it, or are there people kind of using all of those protests or gatherings as a, you know, a cover so that they can, you know, do violent things that otherwise they wouldn't get be able to do without being caught?
Yes and yes.
Wait, so yes, it is the same group, and yes, there are people hiding in all the groups. Is that what we're saying? Okay. You know,
I think it's really hard to know. And the longer this goes on and the more federal troops or state troops or local troops or, you know, all of these people are in our city, and it's very hard to know on a day-to-day basis who is where. They're not telling us that. I mean, we can read what is released to the press, but we don't know. I, from my own personal experience, being again involved in, I think it's one of the prongs Susan was really talking about, was there is very much still a force of people focused on Black Lives Matter, police brutality, that are meeting in their neighborhoods. They are spreading a message of hope. They are spreading a message of love and, you know, neighborhood that gets lost in the national news, because all the country hears about is the violence that's happening at a certain time of day by people. So I think it's a distraction. I think for some people that are participating in that, it's purposeful. But I think it's our responsibility to really make sure the focus stays where the focus needs to be.
I know from a news standpoint, I've felt like every time there's violence in any of the protests for any cause, it's a complete distraction from the purpose of the protest to begin with. Because obviously the minute there's violence and people are at risk and there's destruction, or whether it's, you know, building destruction or fires or looting or whatever it is, you know, it like that becomes the focus because that's the part that's out of control. And then the issues that were supposed to be discussed, they don't even make it to the story, let alone the headline. You know, and I get it because the violence is critical and urgent and immediate. And so the other stuff kind of gets pushed to the side. You know, so you think though that it's predominantly one group though that keeps sort of stirring up trouble, I'll call it, or you're not sure?
I think it's hard. For me, it feels hard to say that. To Susan's point, it's hard to know when the players are common from one violent event to the next. What I can say is that it feels different to me what's happening now in terms of nightly clashes than it did when it was about the federal presence at our justice building. That felt to me very political, and that the people who were there perpetrating violence were there to make a political statement, were there to express political outrage that was more partisan than it had anything to do with our communities of color or racism in our community or anywhere else. And it felt to me, and Susan's been down there, so she may have a different perception of this, but it felt to me like the amplitude of aggression and violence dropped dramatically back down as soon as those federal folks left. Now, that said, I don't happen to live in a neighborhood in Portland where these events are, the larger events are ongoing. There are really three or four geographical areas where the events are centered and happening daily. And I know the folks in those communities probably feel very differently to me.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break for traffic and weather, and then I'm going to have the other Susan respond to that. And I have some questions regarding the federal authorities in town as well. But right now, traffic and weather, WICC 600. We'll be right back to talk more to Susan and Susan from Portland. Welcome back to Connecticut Today. Ann Carrick here, your guest host, and my two guests are Susan and Susan. They're both from Portland. And we're talking about some of the protests and what have sort of evolved in some cases into riots almost that are going on in Portland and why. So we went to the break. So Susan, you were saying that, you know, after the federal agents arrived, and as far as I was told, it was to protect federal buildings because they felt local authorities were not, and we could debate whether that's true or not, but that's what I heard. But that then there was a group of people who were specifically upset at that and seemed to be protesting that action alone, that the federal government had sent some federal troops to your city and that they were violent. And so now my other Susan didn't get to respond to that because we had to go to the traffic and weather. So what were you going to say in response to her comments? And tell me if I summarized that incorrectly also, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a part I agreed with and a part I disagreed with. I do agree that the arrival of federal troops revitalized the numbers that were on the streets and the intensity to which people felt impassioned to be out marching and protesting. I guess the part I disagree with is that they're gone, apparently, and we're still having nightly clashes. I would argue that it is debatable who, which side police protesters are escalating those situations, but it's still happening on a nightly basis. So
are still happening on a nightly basis.
Exactly.
Okay.
On a nightly basis, almost. I mean, there's a break once in a while, which again could be looked at maybe more closely. But I think the fact that those clashes continue now without federal officers being kind of front and center is a statement.
So that excuse, so to speak, is kind of gone, but there's still clashes going on.
Right. I mean, so to me, that it wasn't just the federal troops. It gets us back to the beginning point was these protests are about how are about Black Lives Matter and how Black lives are treated by the police locally and in this country. And until we address that and something changes, I think there will be people in the streets here, whether there are federal troops or not.
Right. Now, you both kind of alluded to something that I'm not sure the rest of us would have known, excuse me, which is that Portland, you know, sort of has a, I don't know if I would call it a history, though, but, you know, that they're passionate that, so to go out and protest in Portland, that in itself is sort of a common way that people express themselves about a multitude of issues. I mean, it's because that may not be true in every city, you know, so that's sort of an important factor that I didn't know before, which would put things in perspective. So if Portland is a pro happy city, meaning like that's how they express themselves, you know, then the idea like, okay, these protests have been going on for, you know, 80 some days. You're like, okay, I get it. That's how they express themselves. So then the question is, who is it that's becoming violent? Why? And you both seem to make it sound like it's mostly late at night, which maybe because of the time difference here, I don't really realize it's always late at night when that's happening. Because I'm either hearing about it in the morning and they say last night, which could have been, you know, 12 hours worth of last night. I don't know when it was. You know, so this thing, we're hearing about it after the fact because we're asleep by the time it happens. You know, on the East Coast, we've already gone to bed probably. So that's true, though, that most of the time you're saying it is late at night. So during the day, would you say that the protests are just, I'll call them just protests, versus what I always say, you know, it's a protest if everybody's peaceful. If they're doing damage, harming people, threatening people, that's a riot. And that's something else. So during the day, they're protests. And it's at night when you're having the issues. Is that yes, no?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, again, I haven't gone out for the purpose of participating in any of the demonstrations. That doesn't mean I haven't been out and been proximal to some of these parts of town where the protests are originating. And on the occasions, probably a handful that I've encountered the beginning or the midst of a demonstration, I haven't experienced any violence. And that's, you know, I've always been out before dark. Well, this time of year before dark is, at least at the beginning of this, was 9:30 at night. And things still seemed like a normal demonstration to me. People whose position is apparent, they have signs or shirts, they have chants, they're paying attention to speakers. Like that to me is sort of what peaceful protest and the power of demonstration is all about.
Right.
It's not about throwing things at buildings or each other or screaming profanity, which is what happens, what it devolves to on a nightly basis to some magnitude or another.
So when you were out and there was no violence happening, you didn't feel unsafe.
No, it's a situation.
Okay. Well, no, that's why I'm asking it. Yeah, no.
If you're with them, you toot your horn and you wave out your window and you go on by and that's all great. And if you don't, maybe you roll down your window and yell something back. That's pretty normal around here, frankly.
So that behavior wouldn't cause violence on either side because that's not normal. Okay. All right. We have to do traffic and weather again. We do it every 10 minutes on the sixes here. So we'll do traffic and weather. We're going to come back and talk more to Susan about what's happening in Portland and get a better understanding of the situation. And that's why I asked you both to be here. So we'll be right back. Welcome back. Ann Carrick, your guest host this week, and my guest this hour, Susan and Susan, both from Portland, with slightly different perspectives on things, but talking to us. Actually, you two agree a lot more than I thought you were going to. But talking to us about what's really going on in Portland, because the news stories often focus on, you know, the violence, the destruction. And so far you've both said, you know, that's happening, but it's mostly later at night, and that during the day and even early evening, that is not the case, that, you know, you don't feel unsafe in town, even if there's a protest going on. You either support it and give them a cheer, or if you don't, maybe say something, or maybe just, you know, move on by kind of thing. So that, I have to say personally, I feel like that's good to hear, because it sounds like it's not maybe as bad as what I was imagining. You know, there was this great audio clip from the mayor, I'm sure you two heard it, about, you know, committing murder or trying to commit murder. Do you know the one I'm talking about? Wait, let me, it's short. I've edited it, so it's short. Let me just play it so other people know what I'm talking about. And I, hopefully you two can hear it also at the same time.
When you commit arson with an accelerant in an attempt to burn down a building that is occupied by people that you have intentionally trapped inside, you are not demonstrating. You are attempting to commit murder.
So that was the mayor, Ted Wheeler. So, of course, when you hear an audio clip like that and you're not anywhere nearby, you think, what is going on in Portland? They're trapping people in a building and setting it on fire. That sounds really bad. So do either of you happen to know what the incident was that he was referring to in that clip? I mean, at a national level, we played it because we're like, wow, that's, it's a strong comment. You know what I'm saying?
I couldn't actually hear it when
you
played it, but I think I'm aware of the clip. It was roughly about, like, if people are setting a building on fire, they're trying to kill people because people are in it type thing.
Yeah, well, he basically says if you try to set a building on fire where you've purposely trapped people inside and they can't get out, you're not demonstrating you're trying to commit murder, roughly is what he said. So do you know what was the incident that was happening that caused him to make that comment? I'm curious. If you don't, you don't. Yeah.
I believe it was one of our precinct buildings.
Okay.
So this is not downtown. This is more in a neighborhood business type area of Portland. Just for people who aren't from here, I've never been here to Portland. Portland is set up as neighborhoods. So it's very distinct. Like, you have neighborhoods that have residential and then also commercial. And then you have it's not just one like commercial center and then residential. It's all very mixed up in these neighborhoods. So I believe this was a precinct building that a group of marchers, protesters had gone to, as Susan was talking about earlier, that really towards the beginning, especially during the federal presence, most of the people are hearing in terms of violent activity was downtown at the federal building, which was really like a 2 or 3 square block of Portland that was affected by that. This is a precinct that's in a different part of town that she kind of alluded to earlier as well. So
where that incident was happening.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And what's the general feel there regarding some of the things, I hate the term defunding police, not to be confused with disbanding police. Those are two different things. What's your all's opinion on that? Because there's been a lot of discussion about that, and I'll remind people who are listening in case they didn't hear the last hour, defunding police, the term sounds like you're taking all their money away. What you're really, the idea of it is to take some of it and redirect it towards social services that would help in the same communities that you're trying to help and police, I mean, what is the general feel in Portland, or either of you? Nobody wants to say.
You want me to go? I'll go.
Go ahead.
So I think for me, it's important to think about in a historical context. Oregon and Portland have a very long history of being very white and very racist. And the
of being very racist also, not just being very white.
Oregon was created as a white-only state.
Oh, okay.
So that is, I think, important for people to have that kind of
to know that history.
Perception. Yes. And the police were part of that, right? Keeping law and order since that time. So I think that's an important perspective for people to have. Personally, from what I have seen growing up here in the Portland area and then coming back as an adult, and from what I've seen over the last 80 some days, I do not believe that our current police force can fix things from within. I think it's become even more clear to me that that's not going to be the change we need to make our streets safe for our neighbors of color. So I think some sort of defunding or dismantling, or you know, I don't pretend to have the perfect model or plan. You know, I think there are others we can look at for information about that, but I personally don't think that that change is going to come from within.
Just because you think, especially in Oregon, that the history, like that the police is like kind of, I'll say, so set in their ways that even the, even if there's people within the department that want to make the change, it's going to be too hard for them to do themselves. Is that kind of, best intentions?
Yes. And the other piece of that is only like 14% of our Portland police live in Portland.
Oh.
And you are policing neighborhoods and areas that are not yours. And so I think that's another important piece to know.
And that was something we talked about with my other guest was, she said the same thing, that a lot of the police officers in New York City are not from New York City. They don't live there. And she said she saw a couple recently that she said they were rookies. I don't know how she knew that, but we'll just say she did. And she said they looked visibly scared. And she's like, you know, and I was saying to her, I'll repeat it since you weren't there, but, and then I have to do traffic and weather again. But I had done an interview with a retired police detective in Connecticut who is Black. And he talked about, you know, that you can't take somebody from a predominantly white neighborhood, train them to be a police officer, and drop them in a minority neighborhood and expect them to feel comfortable and understand everything that's going on there. You know, he said that's unrealistic. He said we can train them, you know, but he said it's obviously better if you have police officers who grew up in some place that looks something like where they're policing, so they understand the situation or the issues firsthand. All right, I'm going to go to traffic and weather. We'll come back and talk about all that more, the police in Oregon and in Portland specifically, right here on WICC 600. Ann Carrick in for Paul Pacelli this week on Connecticut Today. My guests this hour are Susan and Susan from Portland. We're talking about some of the issues taking place there, or I should say the violence, and what are the issues. So one Susan said that you didn't think that the police department was capable of fixing the problem themselves internally. And so my other Susan Havel, you were about to say that you were starting to comment on that same thing, that, you know, the police, that you're kind of agreeing the police department, you don't think, can fix their problems from the inside out, like it's going to take something else. But go ahead and say what you started to say.
I think my perception with the access points that I have to our police force here is that there is a really deep-seated cultural problem that is knit into the department. And I don't know that you practically could correct that kind of a cultural dysfunction without taking the service completely offline, right? You can't rebuild the plane while you're flying it. And I think a testament to that is, I think it's been about 2 years ago now that a new police chief was brought in from Oakland, California, a woman of color with a stellar track record from a much bigger, more metropolitan area. And I think that was done as an acknowledgement of this very issue. And she, I had the opportunity to interact with her through another role of mine here in the city. And while she was in the role, she freely commented that this was a much bigger mess, frankly, than she even imagined when she took the job. Mm. And fewer than 2 years into it, she left Portland for, I think, Philadelphia. And, you know, and here we are back at square one again.
And so she left for Philadelphia. It's not like she was going somewhere where it was necessarily easier, at least not obviously.
Arguably
so,
not.
You know, no. Philadelphia is no like cakewalk either. So from your old perspective, you think she came in from Oakland, maybe brought in to try to help fix the problem, found it was a bigger problem than she realized, and still couldn't get it like a big change, no, or any change. I don't know which, but you know, not a noticeable change, we'll say. Disturbing. You know, because normally I think of the police departments the ones I'm more familiar with, there could be people in it who are a problem, but the vast majority are trying to do a good job. And and the description that you two are giving me is that not necessarily true with the police department there, especially, I guess, depending on what race you are. I mean, did the police seem like they do a good job if it's white people involved? Not, in other words, like, is it all racial, or are they kind of out of control in general? Well, you understand the question I'm saying. In other words, is it specifically race, like where they act one way with one group of people and a different way with others, or are they kind of like, the wild, wild west police all the time with everybody? Do you know?
I think my opinion is any group with whom they are uncomfortable, they struggle.
Okay.
Whether it's people of color or people with mental health issues or people who are homeless, I think they do fine with the community scenario and taking care of the shopkeepers and managing traffic.
Okay.
It isn't totally the wild west, but certainly through my eyes, I feel like they lack the tools to deal with our marginalized populations.
Okay. No, that's a good way of explaining it then, that, sort of anybody who's not like them. All right, it's time again for traffic and weather. So WICC traffic and weather, and we'll come back more with Susan and Susan. And welcome back, Ann Carrick, your guest host, and my guest, Susan and Susan. We're talking about what's going on in Portland. We've been talking about the police department. So I asked you a few more probing questions during the break. And so I can summarize, you let me know if I got this wrong, which is that the police department seems to have a bias, I'll say, against anybody who's not just like them. So minority, health, mental health issue, homeless, whatever. And in addition, the part of the reason that you don't feel comfortable that they could fix the problem themselves internally is that they don't act or say anything that would indicate that they agree there's a problem. So they think everything's fine and they're doing a great job. And in fact, sometimes make comments like, how come nobody's thanking us for all the good things we do? So I was summarizing saying, because you were saying we have to admit you have the problem even on the 12-step program. They haven't even got to step one. I said, yeah, you have to admit there is a problem in order to fix it, but you also have to want to fix it. And from what I was getting from that conversation is they don't have either of those. They don't think there is a problem. And even if you keep telling them there is a problem, they're not interested in changing how they do things. And that's why you said that's why there's people in the streets every night. Did I summarize that pretty much? Is that what we said?
Yeah.
Okay. So the city has already tried to bring in somebody from outside, to fix the problem, and that didn't work. One of you said that the city has diverted some funds away from the police, but they're not even sure where to send them. So that sounds very frustrating to me. Like, you're just kind of in this pattern of like, nothing is changing. There's a problem. Nobody's doing anything about it. Is that pretty much what you think the people in Portland are feeling right now?
Yeah. I mean, I can tell for myself that I'm waiting, I'm waiting for some kind of indication that people are gathering and talking about this virtually or around a table of, let's acknowledge what's going on. Let's figure out how we can move forward. I don't see any indication from that from anyone in our leadership, government, or Portland Police or their union.
So no signs of dialogue saying, okay, let's sit down, tell us what you think the problem is. Even if they said it that way, like, we don't think there's a problem, but come tell us what you think the problem is. We'll listen to you. Not even that.
Correct. I think that the police and the union have been so focused on, again, the acts of violence, and not even addressing what is the underlying message. Why are people in the streets?
Which doesn't resolve anything if that's actually the case, you know. We only have a few minutes left, so I want to make sure, is there something else that we need to mention since we're enlightening everybody on what's happening in Portland? You know, well, you know, I mean, but you guys have been in the news a lot, so that's why I thought it was worth, you know, having you on, because, you know, otherwise, again, what we're hearing is, you know, all the violence at night. And so now people get it, that there's this deeper underlying issue that seems, if I'm summarizing again, it seems to be being ignored. And so that's why people keep going out to try to bring attention to it.
And I think there's no other forum for us to be proactive about this. And I think that's where a lot of the frustration comes from, is that, you know, these issues are not new to our community. The disadvantage of being a person of color or someone not of American heritage in Portland is longstanding. The challenges of our mental health infrastructure are longstanding. Our homeless problem is remarkable. I used to live in San Francisco, and I would argue in a relative scale, it's worse in Portland than it is there.
Like percentage-wise.
Right.
Yeah.
But there just aren't venues, and our leadership, to Susan's point, isn't creating ways to harness the energy, the passion, and the expertise of the people in our community to help resolve these issues. They're taking, it's a one-note response that just keeps being repeated. And that's what's stimulating the action here, not an interest in being violent or, you know, that being sort of our automatic response. This
right.
is a pent-up level of frustration about these issues that are important.
And I think that's true across the country. I know one of my guests Monday said, when I, you know, was asking him about the violence kind of embedded in some of these protests, and he said, anytime you have thousands of people get together, you're always going to have a few that are kind of just determined to be violent, even though the vast majority are not interested in that. You know, the interesting thing, again, from the outside perspective, is that your mayor was supportive of the protests, but you're saying that apparently the mayor's office and other government officials, they're not doing anything to help change the police behavior other than that they support the protests. I mean, and you know what time it is. Traffic and weather again. So we're going to do traffic and weather, WICC 600, and then we'll come and wrap up with Susan and Susan, because I know then we only have a few minutes after that. But right now, traffic and weather.